welcome Nick back to Parent Institute. Nick used to be a student just down the road in Sita, about a few hundred kilometers, about 100 kilometers down the road at Sita. He graduated in, I'm trying to remember, was 2011. Okay, I see. 2011. Why, I guess.
Not that old.
That old. No, it's not that old. So he graduated in 2011 from Sita, then he did his PhD. He did the first grad postdoc at Carnegie Mellon University. And after that, he joined Princeton University for his second postdoc. Nick is an expert in analyzing various secondary anisotropies, understanding and analyzing various secondary anisotropies, the cosmic microwave background data, in particular thermal Sanyard and Lubbock effect, but other types of Sanyard and Lubbock effects as well. And today he's going to tell us how cross correlation can help us dig secondaries out of CMB. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Nayesh, for the great introduction. And I'd like to thank Kendrick, who's not here, for the invitation. So this is some work that I've been doing the past couple years, and most of it's complete. So, and this, with help of these cast of characters here, this is Nayesh. I'll just point with my hands if I have to. Right, so I'm going to be talking about CMB secondaries. But before I can do that, oh, great. Excellent. But before I can talk about CMB secondaries, let me talk about just the greatness of CMB primary anisotropies. So these are anisotropies seen from the surface of last scattering, and we're able to constrain cosmology to better than 1% in our, you know, in our lambda CDM model, measuring things like the amplitude of curvature fluctuations, et cetera, to better than 1%. And this is sort of the foundation we have for our modern cosmology. This is what concordance cosmology is based off of. Lambda CDM is every, you know, essentially started from this, from CMB primaries. But in order to get to that and push it further, we have to worry about foregrounds. This is an example right here. Recently, the Keck Bicep team reported measurements of R, the ratio of tensor to scalar fluctuations, relatively high. Turned out that this was actually, they had some foreground contamination. And so as we push further, measuring the CMB primary anisotropies, secondary anisotropies are going to be important. We need to understand them. In order to, some people want to subtract them. That's not what I want to do. I want to try and use them for cosmology. So there are many sources of CMB secondary anisotropies. There's just stuff in our galaxy like dust, synchrotron. There's also radio and dusty point sources, extragalactic sources. There's also lensing of the CMB. So as the primary CMB comes towards us, it gets deflected by the matter in front of it. And then there's also things like SZ sources, which I'll talk about more. And as you saw from the last slide, understanding these foregrounds is very important. If you don't understand the foregrounds, you may make, there may be errors in your parameter estimations and things like that. But there's also information in these secondary sources. So the point of my talk is to try and show you what we can learn from these secondary sources, in particular SZ sources, and how can we use them to constrain cosmology. And hopefully by the end, I'll convince you that the data, there's tons of data on these secondary sources, and this is really sort of a theory poor field in cosmology. Tons of data, and what's the limiting factor is not data, it's how we understand these sources and how we model these sources. So the CMB itself is a great backlight. It's pretty much uniform to a couple parts in 10 to the minus 2. And as it comes towards us, like I said, there are things that scatter it, and there are things that deflect this uniform backlight. This, you know, the growth of structure in between us, the surface of the last scattering, and us. And over the years, going, say, from WMAP down to what we can do now with ActNSBT. Detector development, better resolution on CMB experiments have allowed us to go from, this is the same patch of sky, looking at the CMB like this, the Planck, which sees the CMB on these angular scales, to ActNSBT, where we start to see these point sources and galaxy clusters coming out. And I'll explain to you, this is the nominal SZ decrement, which I'll get into in a second. And for, as you know, the typical sort of CMB analysis tool is you look at the power spectrum of the CMB. And so this is the primary CMB over here. There's a first bump, second, third bump, and as you come down, you go to higher angular scales, higher resolution. You start to see these secondary sources pick up over here. And the area that I'm interested in, this is sort of the sweet spot for SZ and or TZ and KZ, is around L of 3000. I'll explain why that is in a second. But you can see there are other sources like CIB means this is cosmic infrared backgrounds. These are dusty sources. Pretty much out here, they're unresolved. There's also radio sources shown here. And so there's, you know, once. I switched. I adopted the SZ.
And we did not start a big one that you passed it. But now you're regretting
it. I've assimilated into American culture, unfortunately. As Avery's assimilated into Canadian culture.
Right on. Can't help but notice that.
Yeah,
I stick.
We'll talk about my hockey skills later. I mentioned the TSZ several times already. It is the upscattering of CMB photons as they pass through a hot medium. So what we have here is a hot medium of ionized electrons. Your microwave photon comes in. A few percent of them get upscattered, and they come towards us, and it causes a spectral distortion in the CMB blackbody. So this dashed line is the CMB blackbody. This is an exaggeration of your TSZ spectral distortion. So it's a unique spectral distortion of your cosmic microwave background. And that distortion we define like this. So this is your distortion relative to the background temperature. It has a frequency function that looks like this. The decrement below 217 and increment above. And this distortion is proportional to this Compton Y parameter. And the Compton Y parameter is essentially the integrated electron pressure along the line of sight. That's shown here. And what's great about this integrated electron pressure along the site, it's basically a probe of the thermal energy of the objects which are doing the scattering. So if you have bound halos like galaxy clusters, then this can be a proxy for their mass, how much they distort your CMB. So that's great. I've ignored some details. I haven't talked about the KSZ. I haven't talked about relativistic terms. I will mention them briefly at the end because we have some exciting new stuff on that. As I said, a lot of these are the main source of, or the brightest sources of thermal SZ sources on the sky are galaxy clusters. And that's because if you integrate your little Compton Y parameter over the area, it scales like mass to the 5/3. So your most massive objects, which happen to be the most collapsed, virialized massive objects in the universe, happen to be galaxy clusters. So that means they're going to be the brightest thermal synchronized Rydberg sources on the sky. And what's interesting about these objects is they are a late time measurement of the growth of structure. So at early times, we have the CMB at redshift 1100. And now we have, you know, these objects to constrain how structure's grown from redshift 1100 to now. And that'll become important for measuring parameters beyond, say, our standard lambda CDM model. So how do people do that with SZ sources? Well, you know, there's two main ways people do it. You can just simply go out and count them as a function of redshift and area on the sky. Or you can go out and you can look at their power spectrum, as I showed you earlier. And these both have their pros and cons, which I will show you on this next slide. So if you're counting clusters and you're integrating over the volume element, which has a dependence on your cosmology, and you're integrating over the mass function here, Now this mask function, in order to do it properly, you need to understand the objects you're selecting with your SD sources, and you need to understand how well that you don't actually go out and you don't actually measure the mass, you measure your Y decrement. And so you need to know how well that Y decrement correlates back onto mass. And there's scatter involved. And so this is sort of, this can be messy. It's not just simple linear physics. For the power spectrum, you're again integrating over your volume element. Now it's the power spectrum, so you don't have to count objects. You're looking at actually just diffuse objects on the sky. And so what you need to understand is what these objects look like in Fourier space. So this is the integrated, sorry, this is the pressure profile, the Fourier transform of the pressure profile squared. And so these sort of selection functions, mass proxy, and your pressure profile are sort of the messy sort of gastrophysics involved in these simple calculations. And modeling them is tricky. You can do it, there's two main ways people like to do it. People like to fully simulate them, or you have some sort of semi-analytic model for given cluster mass, what does the, you know, pressure profile look like. Now when you're doing this, clusters aren't simple spherical objects. They're messy. As we see here, this is the bullet cluster. Here's the hot gas right here in orange. Here's the actual matter shown in blue or purple. And when you do this, you need to model things like radiative cooling. We know galaxy clusters have galaxies in them, which means they form stars. So, you know, the hot gas in them needed to cool at some point. We know that there are stars in them because there's galaxies in them. We do see forms of feedback. Brian McNamara likes to talk about this a lot. There's AGN feedback in galaxy clusters. There may be stellar feedback earlier on. There's also non-thermal pressure support in galaxy clusters. There's large bulk motions that actually cause additional pressure within the galaxy cluster. So they're not just, you know, thermal objects. There's cosmic rays, magnetic fields. These we expect to be subdominant. And they're not spherical, as you can see in this picture here, the pink. That definitely does not look like a sphere. So these are things that need to be modeled. Now, in simulations, you can sort of have subgrid models for these things I've shown in red. In white, these come out naturally in your hydrodynamic simulations. In semi-analytic models, you have to include them somehow, which can be difficult. And the only way to do that, you can't really measure these empirically. So the only way to do it is sort of take results from simulations and then plug them into your semi-analytic model. But the point is, this is sort of the sticking point in CMB secondary cosmology, is how do we model the medium within galaxy clusters? And to sort of highlight the uncertainties, this is an example of cosmological constraints from ACT. So this is the amplitude of the normalization of the power spectrum. And this is your omega m. So that's the energy, density, and matter currently, matter density of the universe. And so what I'm showing you here is these are constraints using ACT. So what ACT is the Atacama Cosmology Telescope. And it looks at the, measures the CMB, and we see galaxy clusters in the SZ. And what these banana curves are showing you here are three different models for the ICM. And you can see that, you know, if we knew one model, we'd have, you know, pretty decent constraints on sigma 8 omega m. But these models are equally viable for the ICM. So you can see how you basically have to marginalize over everything here. And so, you know, this is sort of the current state. We can add more clusters, but that won't help in our ability to not really understand the gastrophysics. So that's sort of where we are. In terms of the power spectrum, this figure was given to me in January, and it's already out of date. I'm showing you here just the different CMB power spectra. So we've taken out the foregrounds here from several different experiments: Planck, ACT, SPT, BICEP, Polar Bear, and you can see this. Yeah, this is already out of date. There's already more plots, especially in the BB, which I won't talk about, or the EE. But you know, we're doing really well out to high angular scales, measuring the CMB damping tail. When you start to add secondaries, it looks like this. And you can see we're really constraining this damping tail over multiple frequencies, which is important. And then you can add in sort of what we models for our secondaries. Now, this was on a previous slide, but the amplitude of this curve right here, the TZ power spectrum, is actually very sensitive to sigma 8. So this sort of is how people initially envisioned constraining cosmology with the TZ power spectrum. Now, it'd be nice if we could sort of eliminate the CMB up here. We know its spectral shape. We know it's a black body. We have enough frequencies. Can we actually sort of eliminate the CMB here and go after what the TSZ looks like? Because we know the thermal SZ has a unique spectral shape.
Sorry, why is there such a big difference between the TSZ and the KSZ? I would have expected the KSZ to be a lower amplitude.
Right. This really depends on what you assume for your cross-correlation between TSZ and CIB. So this is something that, you know, we were puzzling with. This is the best fit. There's not an actual detection of the KSZ. If you look at the fully marginalized parameter, there's no 2-sigma detection of the KSZ. And so this is just sort of the best fit lines. But we do have a detection of the TSZ. But yes, in principle, they should be flipped by about an order of magnitude. So this is sort of a puzzle as well. Yes?
Sensitive to the filtering scale and the mass function, so like, you know, baryons, Chertoff star correlation, but also mass, some halo mass or something, is it sensitive to that filtering scale as well?
Yes, it is sensitive to the mass function. And so if there is something happening on a given scale, say.
So I'm just thinking like the baryons, just, you know, just the filtering scale of the baryons, it's sensitive to that.
Right, yes. So there are people who have been writing papers about the mass function changing as they crank up feedback and things like that, and that would affect sort of the amplitude as well of the TSC power spectrum.
Is it as sensitive as the sigma 8? Is it like power
sensitive? Well, so the 8th power sensitive comes from the fact that a lot of this contribution comes from the high mass, towards the high mass end. So If your mass function is changing things on like 10 to the 12 solar masses, then it won't really make that much of a difference. But I don't think anybody's fully done that calculation to get a scaling with sort of. Right. Yeah, I don't think anybody's done that calculation.
Is the KSC, are these the values you get are consistent with, the expectations? The fact that TSC and the KSC, that the order is flipped, and you said that there's a detection of KSC.
Right. No, it's not consistent with what we'd expect from theory.
Okay, it's higher or lower?
Like Phil pointed out, that you'd expect the TSC to be about I think it's almost an order of magnitude, maybe factor of 5 larger than the KSC.
Okay, so that's the relative, but the actual amplitude.
I'll get to that. I'm going to get to that. Yeah, the actual amplitude is low as well. So I was saying we were interested in getting at, you know, maybe constraining things down here as well, instead of just at L of 3,000, where you can see sort of the best signal to noise would be for your TSC. And Planck has done that. Planck has several frequencies, and they're able to extract this unique spectral distortion of the CMB. So this is their Planck Y-map. So all these big red dots are actual galaxy clusters shown in their Y decrement. And that's the Coma cluster right there. And so this is pretty neat. So they actually have a map, and they can just take the power spectrum of said map and get a constraint as well at low Ls. So that's what they've done, and this is sort of the state of the art. I need to update the Planck points here. This is sort of the state of the art of where the TC power spectrum is on, at low L and at this L of 3000 limit from Act and SPT. So let me just, so these are the Planck points. So this is the power spectrum of that map I showed you. These are the constraints at L of 3000 from Act and SPT. This red line is the best fit curve from our simulations for sigma 8 of about 0.8, which is around the fiducial value depending on who you ask. And then this gray band here is the expected amplitude of your TSC power spectrum if the Planck cosmology is correct. So if you know Planck has a value for sigma 8 omega m, and if it's correct, this is what you'd expect. So you can see there is some discrepancies at low L. We'll get to that. And there is even discrepancies, sorry, there's discrepancies at low L, and there's a major discrepancy at high L. This is a 2 sigma upper limit. And this is not just in, so these are our simulations I'm showing in red. This is not just our simulations. Simulations from another group show this as well. Here's the Planck points. Here's the best fit Planck cosmology in their simulations. And here are the constraints.
So do you know how this has changed?
The 2015 parameters haven't moved.
They haven't
moved, but the likelihood paper still isn't out, so I'm going to hold judgment on whether or not they, on their.
The parameters that are quoted, they haven't reduced. The optical depth went down, and the sigma 8 also went up.
So the optical depth went down, but their calibration changed. And so the calibration almost completely compensated for their optical depth.
So the parameters haven't moved.
Right.
And like, can you assign a sigma to this discrepancy? Like, I'm basically.
Okay. Well, so this is a 2 sigma upper limit. So, you know, as it's more than 2 sigma. I can tell you that.
I
don't want. I mean, this number has changed a little bit. This was the old Act in SPT. SPT has a new paper out, which I haven't folded in here, but it's around a similar value. You know, maybe it's 3 sigma. The error bar is kind of large, so.
Just one stupid question. How many L's do I have to get before I have to start worrying about highly nonlinear complicated things, which I might worry about whether I'm modeling right or not?
Right. Well, so these are nonlinear objects already. So you have to do full. At least you have to do full n-body almost in order to do this properly, because these are all collapsed, serialized objects. So in theory, in semi-analytic or full simulations, you're always putting in some assumption of the mass function. Okay, so there's an issue here, which I'll address, and then I'll sort of point out maybe how we can get at this issue here. And so the details are messy. Yes. So let me sort of distill what Dick was trying to say. What's going on with the secondaries? Well, there is the messy gastrophysics that I was talking about earlier, and we can sort of summarize that. And what does the pressure profile look like? And so I'll show you some results for that. Is there contamination from CIB and IR sources as we go to higher redshifts? You know, these objects are the most massive objects always throughout cosmic time. And so sometimes there is star formation, heavily, lots of star formation, which also comes with dust. So maybe there's some dust fill-in at higher redshifts. Is there new physics? This has been posed several times now with the Planck cluster cosmology versus the Planck primary CMB anisotropies. Are we seeing evidence for a neutrino mass? Or as people have pointed out, is there something wrong with our mass function that we're assuming? In the simulations, this should be fine. But if you're doing a halo calculation, maybe that's coming in. So let's just see how some of our simulated observables compare to actual empirical data. So I'm showing you here, this solid red curve is the only one you really need to worry about. This is a simulation with everything in it, feedback, AGM feedback, rate of cooling, cosmic rays, everything. And this is this solid black sort of curve here, dark gray, shows you measurements from X-ray, from XMM, which is an X-ray satellite, of local large X-ray clusters. And you can see that our simulations do fairly well to match. This is, I'm showing you pressure profile times R cubed, so you can get idea as a function of R. So this is dE, dLon, and R. So this kind of gives you the total thermal energy as a function of dLon, R. And you can see we do fairly well to match the observations here. Don't worry about this. This is not observations. This is old simulations. So that does well for local, very massive, bright X-ray clusters. You can look at it again in the SZ. So Planck went out and they stacked on their SZ sources, their galaxy clusters, and they got these points here. So these red points are their stacked SZ pressure profile as a function of radius. And these purple dots are the same curve I showed you last time. And our simulations are shown in brown. And they do fairly well to match the pressure profile inwards and all the way outwards. So that's pretty good. So, you know.
I mean, you seem to be over predicting it for the last, I don't know, 5 years.
Right. Within the errors, it's pretty reasonable. But yeah, we seem to see a little bit of an excess out here. So that could be interesting. This is SZ selected. So there's cool core clusters in here. There's non-cool core clusters, everything.
But does it matter if you split between those? I mean, obviously, a bit of spread in the core.
Right, that's a good question. So out here, it does not matter.
Yeah.
In the interior, it does. When you talk about things like the total SZ signal from an object or the SZ power spectrum, the core really doesn't matter. That's why when we plot it, we like to plot it as a function of R cubed, because this is sort of the area that matters.
What is the
previous slide?
Before this one? This one?
What are the blue and green?
OK. Blue were those old simulations I was talking about earlier. So they're still using lambda CDM. What these simulations lack is a form of feedback in their core. So what they have is they have a runaway cooling effect. And they actually take away too many baryons from their intercluster medium and put them into stars. So that lowers their pressure. You can see they're just low all the way through. Well, except in the core. And these are simulations still to be published. So I can't tell you anything about them. But they were supposed to be published back in 2012. But they're supposed to be similar to ours. I think they have slightly better resolution. They also have sort of everything in them. But I can't tell you details because the paper has not come out. These are Planck clusters. So this is low redshift, high mass clusters again. Once we go to higher redshift, this is an SPT selected sample, and they're using X-rays again to measure the average pressure profile as a function of radius. So again, this is a stacking analysis with these simulations still in prep. This came out last year. And you can see, so our model is in green, and it does, again, fairly well to match the observations. And so this is now pushing to higher redshift. So SPT can see galaxy clusters and actually see galaxy clusters out to redshift 1 and beyond, mostly high mass. So these are high mass clusters beyond redshift 3. This is their low redshift bin for Planck. So this isn't their measurement. This is their medium redshift SPT measurement. This is the high redshift SPT measurement. So you know, our simulations seem to do well when compared empirically to the pressure profile, which is sort of the main ingredient when you're looking at SZ statistics. And it also works at higher redshifts. So this is pretty great. So we think we understand the total thermal energy in objects and its radial profile out to high redshift in massive objects. So that means there could be a problem at low redshift. Or sorry, there could be a problem with sigma 8 for the low L points. There are issues not just in cluster counts, So this is the recent Planck cluster counts. This is the Planck cosmology. And these are ellipses here, or blobs, I should say, are three different calibrations of their SZ mass relation. These are weak lensing calibrations from two different teams, and these are CMB lensing calibrations of galaxy clusters. This here is a neat idea led by Colin Hill and the ACT collaboration. It's showing, why don't we just look at the PDF of these sources on the sky? So the PDF has, you know, in principle, all the information, not just information of the two-point function, but three-point, four-point, et cetera. And so you can model this, too, with simulations and analytic theory. And so when you compare what we, you know, expect given cosmology to what we see in ACT, given a filter scale, you know, we get a sigma 8 that's, you know, lower than what Planck would.
So PDF of what?
You're just counting pixels.
PDF of pixels?
Yeah.
In the Y
map? Not in a Y map. This is in a CMB map. CDM, so you have a CMB map, and there's going to be TSZ sources in there. And so, you know, you're going to have your CMB Gaussian part, and this, you know, see this is extends that these are negative, these are decrements.
I know there could be that foreground and things like that.
So there could be, but at these sort of decrements here, we'd expect, this has also been filtered to a certain scale. So
foreground.
So,
there are just non-Gaussian, so I guess there would be, there are very bright sources, obviously there would be increments, but then we could have four.
Yeah, so we're only modeling this, the negative part of the PDF here. And a lot of the information comes from this tail out here. Synchrotron dusts are all going to be excess, positive.
Yeah.
So, you know, there seems to be, you know, so this is all in relation to this. These are, you know, low redshift massive objects. This red curve seems to be pretty legitimate, and it seems to match also sort of. By a sigma 8 of 0.02. The SC flux. Can I sort of phrase that another way? You'd have to change the masses by about 30%. That's a rough. That's a rough number. You mean
their SC pluses?
Yeah, so simulations are over predicting the sigma, right?
No, it depends where you look. So,
the plot you were just showing compared this one, yeah.
The red's a simulation, the simulation matches, but the extrapolation of the primary CMB doesn't match.
Simulations over predict here. But here, they're going basically right through the data points. And Planck has a best fit sort of CMB power spectrum, and it matches ours from here all the way down to here. Yeah.
No, but you have to put in the model for SC. But I think that the model that Planck put is is not as good as yours, or?
No, I'm saying they're equal. Planck has a Halo calculation
that
matches ours fairly well at low redshift.
So very, very well.
Gray is if you take the Planck primary sigma 8 constraints and you apply the scaling that we know to the theory curve, this is where you'd expect the amplitude to be.
Right.
And this is where it is measured, and this is where the simulation is also predicted to be.
With a lower sigma
8? Yeah, lower sigma 8.
So that's, I mean, obviously, if you play the sigma 8, you can fit it, but the point is Planck, primary CMB measures sigma 8. If you use that sigma 8, you overpredict the...
Right, that's shown. Yeah, that's shown here.
Yeah.
So they use Planck cosmology because they had the added benefit of coming out after the Planck cosmology came out. And so they showed what it looks like. When
that shows you can also reduce the signal by cranking up the feedback at a fixed mass or a fixed sigma 8, I guess, right?
That's true.
Does that affect the pressure profile?
It alters the pressure profile quite a bit. It also alters the IgM temperature. And I'll get there will be constraints on this soon, and there are some constraints from Lyman Alpha Forus on your IgM temperatures. This is a very extreme. So if you were to go, so these are simulations by Ian McCarthy and collaborators. If you go ask Ian if he believes this magenta curve, I think he'd say no. I think it was just sort of we have a model, we have some parameters. Let's see what we can do. Let's see what sort of extremes we have to go to try and fit the these points down here and the Planck cosmology.
Yes.
This is the angular acoustical power spectrum.
Yes.
I've got the mass power spectrum, MIT.
The mass power spectrum.
Well, you survey all the pairs of galaxies and correlate them.
Right, so you're talking about like the baryon acoustic scale.
It's a combination.
Right. And the separation, yeah.
STSS, blah, blah.
Right. BOSS, yes. So they're folded into the Planck cosmology. In terms of us simulating them, we don't have enough volume to do that. You really need really large simulations to do that, right? You need to, the baryonic acoustic scale, which BOSS, STSS, the people that do galaxy pair correlations, you need a gigaparsec, multiple gigaparsec size simulations. The simulations we have are around 200 megaparsecs to 400. Yeah, so and the acoustic scale today is around 120 megaparsecs, so we get maybe one acoustic scale in there. You know, we don't really resolve these large wavelength modes that you need to do this properly. And in fact, I don't think there's any simulations out there right now with hydrodynamics in them that do baryons properly. Then you also have to trust that you're simulating galaxies properly. That's another question altogether. So the simulations we did were sort of tuned to go after the question of what's going on in the intercluster medium. Right. So what's going on at low redshift? Well, we know basically all the objects at low redshift above a given mass, at least massive objects. So why not just cross-correlate with them? So this is cross-correlating with cluster sources in CMB maps. There's been a long history of it. NIESH did some work back in the mid-2000s on this. Stacking is basically a stacking analysis where you stack clusters or you stack CMB maps on positions of clusters. And so what we did was we did this again. We used a subsample of X-ray clusters, a flux-limited subsample, and we did this on Planck. And we also checked with WMAP to see if it worked out. And we did this both in the simulations and on the data. And so what we had to do was, given this X-ray selection, we had to model the selection function. And to do that, we assume some LX scaling relation that we end up marginalizing over. We assume some scatter in that scaling relation. And then we assume some bias. Let's say they screwed up their masses. Yes, Dottie?
Sorry, I just want to get back to what John said. You can think of all these constraints on the power spectrum here as integral constraints on the power spectrum, right? right? Like the sigma is an integral constraint on P of K, the mass function is some integral of P of K. And you know, you remember this plot that Renee made in like 2010 and put like all the measurements that we have of the power spec of different things extrapolated onto P of K, and your clusters are like a single data point that sits on there. Can you do that with all the stuff that we know about TSE? Can you unwind things and put it as like a, you know, simple to understand, you know, here's like one error bar on one or two data points on like the effective linear P of K or whatever?
I think you can probably do that now with the Planck low L measurements of the TSE power spectrum. Before, we only had one sort of data point at L of 3000. So that doesn't really give you sort of scale information.
But you can somehow think about unwinding these things and putting them as effective.
Right.
Like,
right.
The sigma 8, roughly, and sigma 8 is minus scale. So.
But you could think of it as other points if you want.
Yeah, definitely.
Morally, there's something similar.
Yeah, I think you can do that. I think there are lots of uncertainties, as we've been going into, that you probably have to fold in. I don't think anybody's done that, so that could be an interesting exercise. When we stacked, though, we kept it in L space. So we took resolved objects that we knew about from this X-ray cluster catalog, stacked in L space. We also did this in the simulations to give sort of a theory curve where we can, you know, marginalize over these assumptions that we've made. And so here are the results. Here you can see the decrement as a function of L. This is at 200 gigahertz and 96 gigahertz. This is the best fit simulation line. We actually fit to all three of these band. So this is at 143. Here's 220 at the null. So if there are any sort of contamination in these objects, these are low redshift galaxy clusters. We'd see it coming up here. And so you can see there's no sort of CIB or IR fill-in in these objects. This sort of cuts off at redshift 0.4. And then here you can see the excess too, which is nice at 353 gigahertz. And so we fit, given a template from the simulations, we fit an amplitude, because the shape's actually fairly nice. And that amplitude gives you then a constraint on sigma 8 given simulations. And then you can.
So, is this maybe one halo or two halo?
This is all one halo.
All one halo. No
question. Two halo terms is going to be pretty small. I mean, the objects we used, there's like 600 objects. So to do sort of cluster to cluster pair analysis, you get a lot of shot noise in it. But people do not just galaxy pairs, but people also try and do this with galaxy clusters. There's just not that many, so it becomes difficult. Right. My understanding of the current BOSS data is that it's not in that much tension with the CMB, so I don't know about. So maybe that's changed in the past. So here are our constraints given this cross correlation analysis, which are really nice. They fall basically right in the middle of Planck and WMAP. They're higher than what you'd get from the SC clusters from Planck. And it's about a 1% measurement after we've marginalized over all the uncertainties and, say, the bias of these objects, uncertainty in the LXM scaling relation. So this is fairly nice. And all of this really hinges on, we can actually constrain this much better if we knew the exact masses of these objects that we're stacking on. And so a project that we undertook in the past year was to go out and measure this. So we used SDSS weak lensing shape catalogs from Reyes et al. And we went and we stacked on these same objects, and we get nice lensing curves. So that's shown in here in the red points. And the green and the blue are the best fit NFW and fit to simulations, given what we understand about the selection function. And from this, these amplitudes, you can fit these amplitudes again, and you get a constraint on the mass relative to what the X-rays say the masses are. given their x-ray scaling relation. So when you do that exercise and you compare the ratios of what we get from the weak lensing to the x-rays, we get a mass bias shown here. So this is the ratio of x-ray masses to weak lensing masses. You see the weak lensing masses that we get are much more massive than what they get in the x-rays. That means that the x-rays are actually biased low, which is kind of interesting. That bumps your sigma 8 constraints up on your Planck SD cluster measurements because they're all informed by x-rays, all the Planck. That's a whole other talk, which I won't get into, but they're all informed by x-ray scaling relations. So you can see it's about 30% mass bias, which is neat. And we've constrained this to pretty high accuracy. This is about to 10% we've constrained this. And so that actually increases our constraining power of this previous curve a little bit. We've assumed 20% uncertainty here. Right. So that's all at low redshift. So we think we understand this. We think this is actually fairly robust. The data points, the simulations, everything seems to work out quite nicely. So what is really going on here? How can we accommodate this and accommodate this? Well, at
So you're saying that you understand this because the masses in the gray curve, the masses were overestimated, and in fact, masses are smaller than.
I would say we understand this because the pressure profile of the main halos that contribute to this are fairly well understood, you know, match the simulations. So the observations and the simulations agree fairly well. And over a wide range of observations, they tend to agree.
That's fine. What's wrong with the gray region?
Well, so that is again Planck cosmology. So this is given Planck cosmology, we scale up the theory curve. So you know this is saying maybe there is something going on between what we measure for sigma 8 at redshift 1100 and now.
So you think so there's still room for something between redshift 1000 and now?
Definitely. There is still room. I'm not going to say we've detected anything like neutrino mass. But there is something there, possibly.
You're saying it's not
gastrophysics. I'm understand the gastrophysics. I'm saying given the simulations and the rigorous tests that they've been up against to the observations, they seem to perform fairly well. And then additional observables from those simulations to new observations also perform fairly well. And they all give consistent answers for local high mass objects.
Something fraction higher.
This one?
Yeah. See, that doesn't look like the thing that says Planck 13 is the CMB anisotropies, right?
Right.
So it's not in conflict with that.
No, it's not. But it prefers a lower omega m than, a little bit. So, you know, we have this nice, we carve out this swath here, and then when you marginal, you know, when you combine it with Planck.
You could pick a point in there that agrees with all within 2 sigma, right?
Right. Yeah. That's a completely fair statement. Okay. Where was I? Right. L of 3000. What's going on there? So at L of 3000, a lot of the objects are no longer local and they're no longer massive. So these red curves here show you the contribution at 50%. To the power spectrum at L of 3000. So you can see that about 50% comes from lower mass, higher redshift objects. This is the 75%, and this is 25%. So we don't really have measurements of these objects at all. These are, you're approaching group scales above redshift 5. So there's no direct observation of these objects besides the TSC power spectrum. So can we get a handle on what's going on with these objects? And I'm running out of time, so I'll briefly tell you that we're starting to probe these objects. So this is showing you cross correlations between a Planck Y-map or a reconstruction of a Planck Y-map before it was public with CMB lensing. And this is a cross correlation of another self-constructed Planck Y-map with galaxy-galaxy lensing or weak lensing of halos. And these, you know, these are early stages, but these two detections were about six sigma, and it's only going to get better. The Y-map that both of these, or they had their own Y-maps, but the Y-maps that they used are now worse compared to what the public Planck Y-map is. So you know, you can probably redo these, increase your signal to noise, and the weak lensing of the CMB is only going to get better, and galaxy weak lensing is going to get even better as well over the next couple of years. And so we sort of explored what can you learn from these objects given simulations and a halo model. I won't go into details, but I will say that this is showing you predictions of, I'll just show you for mass in the first case. This is Y cross CMB lensing. You can see you're probing a lot of your signal depending on your L is coming from objects less than 5 times 10 to the 13. So these are objects that we have, you know, really no idea what's going on with their gastrophysics. Here, this is Y cross galaxy lensing. It really depends on your survey. Each survey has their own different redshift kernel and source kernel. But given that, you're starting to probe masses of around 10 to the 14. You can see here the green curve gives you the most contribution compared to the purple curve. And so these, you know, these two new cross-correlation techniques are going to be very powerful to sort of disentangle what's going on at different redshifts and different masses in your TSC power spectrum. Another thing we did was we looked at where are these contributions coming from, and you can see a lot of them are coming from, as a function of L, many of them are coming from well inside. So this is the amount of power you get inside a given radius. So this is inside R200. This is inside 2R200. You know, a lot of them, it's above 80 to 90%. So you're really probing, again, the interior of these objects. So what this means is these sort of cross correlations in the future are going to probe higher redshifts and lower masses, and they're going to be probing what we're interested in, the intercluster medium, not things outside the intercluster medium. And you can compare to the observations given different cosmologies. Now the error bars are so large you can't really sort of, you can make constraints, but you have to assume something about how well you understand your astrophysics before, because it's degenerate with both the astrophysics and cosmology. So this is a comparison to the CMB lensing cross Y, and then this is the galaxy lensing cross Y measurement. Six sigma detections I just told you about. Now in the future, we're going to have a large coverage to high angular resolution from ACPOL, and this is going to overlap with tons of new surveys coming out. So there's the dark energy survey, there's the HSC survey. Eventually this will all be covered by LSST. So that's really exciting. That's going to give us weak lensing of basically everything in this patch right here. ACT will give you CMB lensing or advanced ACT, and advanced ACT will measure this in 5 frequency bands. Which means we can even make a Y map with ACT, which will be really exciting. So it'll be much higher resolution than what we get with the Planck Y map. We might need to fold in some information from Planck, but that's another story. So there's a lot more area to do these cross correlations with, which means they're only going to get better. Plus, there's Euclid's going to go in the sky. There's WFIRST. So this is going to be, you know, a really exciting time for cross correlating CMB products, CMB secondaries with auxiliary data such as weak lensing data, such as CMB lensing data.
Which frequency bands are currently funded?
There are 5 frequency bands funded. Right now we have a 90 and 150 being tested and looking on the sky.
Okay.
But it, Advanced Act is fully funded. So everything is fully funded for 4 or 5 years. So that's pretty, it's pretty exciting.
Right.
And then, you know, given these exciting possibilities for cross correlations, we went ahead and we just did quick forecasts, and it looks like you can measure sort of these parameters that you use to parameterize your pressure profile to better than, well, some of them you get to about 22%, but you can start constraining the redshift dependence of your pressure profile amplitude to about 13%. You can constrain the slope of your pressure profile. So that's what NIESH was worried about at high or large radii, to about 4%, and you can constrain the amplitude of your pressure profile to about 20%. So it's pretty exciting. And you can even start doing tomography. So if you start breaking these surveys up into different redshift slices, given their sources, you can start to, you know, probe your TSZ contribution as a function of redshift, which is really neat. So you can start doing 3D power spectra instead of 2D power spectra. And quickly, let me just say something about Pixie. So Pixie is a proposed mission. It's a mid-class space mission. And its main goal is to measure the amplitude of scalar to tensor fluctuations to 10 to the minus 3. But one thing it's going to do is it's going to measure the CMB spectrum to very, very high accuracy. What that means is you'll be able to see spectral distortions very, very well out to its resolution. So its resolution is around a degree. So you won't really be resolving clusters. Clusters are much smaller than that. But what you'll end up getting is a mean spectral distortion of the Y parameter of all sky, which is very interesting. That mean spectral distortion will have contributions from halos, such as galaxy clusters. This is actually the dominant contribution. But you can also start to think about constraints on your IGM temperature and your reionization, so Y distortions from reionization. And also, if you have something else that's ionizing the universe and heating it up, you can maybe get a constraint on that. But what this mean Y parameter will do, this will be a very, you know, stringent test for anybody who does simulations. So I don't know if anybody has seen these, you know, looked at Nature recently and seen these articles on the illustrious simulation or Eagles. Those simulations will be definitely put to the test by this parameter here. This is telling you what's the total integrated thermal energy that's allowed to be put into the universe after reionization. And if they don't match that, because they have various prescriptions for feedback, stellar feedback, all that, if they don't match that, then you can kind of sort of say, I don't believe your simulations. The improvement in the limits, so Kobe Firas is currently the best limit on this, limits the mean spectral Y distortion to 10 to the minus 5. That's pretty weak. You know, given simulations and halo calculations, we expect this to come in around 10 to the minus 6, so it's still an order of magnitude too low. Pixie will measure this to 2 times 10 to the minus 9. So that's incredible. And one thing it will do is, because of this great spectral resolution and sensitivity, if they meet their specs, we can measure a 50 sigma detection of the relativistic Y correction, which is really neat. This relativistic Y basically tells you what the effective temperature of high mass halos is. So that's another constraint on how much energy can be put into these objects. So this is really exciting. And this is some work. We have 2 papers in prep on this. So look for those coming out shortly.
But what realistic, is there a floor to the realistic accuracy with which you can predict why the Y distortion, if it really is just coming from cluster feedback and so forth?
Right.
There's no exotic effects, just astrophysics. Is it the sort of thing where that sensitivity will always be way below what you can realistically get to? In terms of a prediction.
So are you asking, will?
So will simulations ever be able to predict the Compton Y parameter to an accuracy of 10 to the minus 9? Or in other words, Pixie will see a non-zero decrement.
Right.
And will that have been predicted
to better, worse, or it's not clear accuracy than what it measures by the time it flies?
It's not. So simulations can, I mean, you can predict the mean y. I mean, I have calculated mean y from my simulations.
But they have some uncertainty on that prediction.
Right, given certain assumptions of your subgrid physics. You can also write out a Hale calculation that will also have uncertainties given the sort of model, the parameters you put in for, say, your pressure profile, et cetera.
I'm just wondering if you have a sense of whether it will get, is it expected to get, is there anyone who hopes to predict it that accurately, or?
I mean, I would hope that all this computer time spent on these high-resolution galaxy simulations will get it right. Whether or not they do, I don't know. I mean, what I'm saying is this will be a test for them. So this will be a number that will be there to very, very high accuracy. And if your simulation doesn't reproduce that number, then
you
have to change your knobs. But once you change one knob, then that may affect another observable that you were previously reproducing in the past. So these simulations like to say, oh, we produce the right angular momentum, morphology relations that we see in the local universe. But to do that, there's, you know, sort of these toy extreme models for feedback that they have in there. And those will be put to the test by these. There's two numbers too, right? There's also this effective temperature that you get from the higher mass halos due to the relativistic corrections.
In other words, I guess the big thing I'm asking about is because I've read a bunch of papers where people say, you know, the Pixie will come along, it'll have this incredible accuracy on the Compton Y parameter, and we can use that to test for all sorts of tiny incremental effects that could be also contributing to the decrement in addition to cluster physics.
Good.
But I guess that only works if you can predict. I hadn't really appreciated cluster physics was going to already predict a decrement that was 3 orders of magnitude above the Pixie sensitivity. Is it really realistic to imagine that cluster physics will be so under control that they'll be predicting their decrement to a part in 1,000? Or should I really regard the sensitivity in terms of detecting new physics as being the error bar on the simulations, not the Pixie sensitivity?
That's a really good question. The dominant Y, as far as we can tell, is going to be coming from halos. Anything from the IGM, if you want to measure, say, the Compton Y from IGM, Compton Y from renization, Compton Y from any sort of exotic physics that doesn't break tau, is at least an order of magnitude smaller. So you need to understand your Y parameter from halos to better than a part in 10. You can do things like masking, but with Pixie's beam being a degree, that becomes very difficult. So these are all things that we did think about and are addressing in these two papers that we're writing.
I have just one other question are the 400 frequency channels, is that what you need to get to R of the clean foregrounds well enough to get to R of 10 to the minus 3, or is that 400 channels overkill so you can also get a really good Y parameter?
That's a good question to ask Al Kogut. I don't know exactly why they chose to go to 400 frequencies, but it is great that they do because then they get these great spectral. I think you can clean foregrounds with. I mean, you only need as many frequency channels as parameters you have in your foreground cleaning model, right? I think.
Yeah, the right answer is you put as many parameters as you have frequency.
I thought many frequencies you can tell the difference between the dust curve and the gravitational wave curve because there's a significant difference if you know a lot of frequencies.
Right. So that was one of the goals is they're going to try and clean out dust completely. I think that was one of the reasons why they chose many frequency channels. I just don't know why their exact reason for 400. Might be technology driven too.
Mike, you showed the plot comparing the X-ray mass to the lensing mass. I don't know if they have to see it again. It's like 70% or something. What is the physical reason why the X-ray masses are much lower than the lensing masses?
Right. So Those X-ray masses, which calibrated that LXM scaling relation, assumed hydrostatic equilibrium. Now, looking at simulations, you can see that clusters aren't in hydrostatic, well, they're in sort of a pseudo-hydrostatic equilibrium, but it's not just thermal pressure balancing gravity. There's additional non-thermal contributions, which come from gas infalling, moving around in bulk motions, turbulence. That adds about on the order of 30%, if you believe simulations.
My own impression may be wrong, as people would say, oh, that's a 10% effect, but you're saying it's 30%.
No, it's much larger. And there's also calibration issues, too, with X-ray satellites. So there may be some calibration issues in there, too, folded in. I mean, it's all just one. It all gets folded into this bias parameter. But if you look at simulations, you calculate the derivative of the pressure profile, and you compare that to the gravitational potential or the total enclosed mass, you do get about 20 to 30% effects, depending on how you smooth your pressure profile and things like that.
What about the bullet cluster? I'm saying you could tell the pressure.
I think maybe we should let Iris figure out how for
them. Also, the bullet cluster, I mean, there's also assumptions of, that's a good question. Bullet cluster, to do this, right, you also assume spherical symmetry, right, when you do your, so, you know, I can go back to the picture of the bullet cluster, but looking at the bullet cluster, it's definitely not a spherical object, right? There's almost two distinct blobs of gas and two distinct gravitational potentials, right? You know, the one thing's rammed through the other. So.
To model the peaks. You don't use
No, but you still have to, in order to get the gradient, right, you want to measure the gradient in the pressure profile and compare it to a spherical potential. That's how everybody does it in hydrostatic equilibrium. Right.
Otherwise, you have to calculate the surface, the sickness.
Right.
But you don't use the signature.
Right. So there's still an offset in the bullet cluster between the gas and the dark matter.
Because,
sorry, these are my...
sorry, yeah, let's thank Nick. So I had one question. I mean, you also have, in addition to those two numbers, you also have the spatial structure in the pixie, because it has 1 degree resolution. So in principle, if something happens at high redshift or at low redshift, then it would appear at different angular scales. That's the main heating, for example.
That's correct. So. A collaborator of mine, Colin Hill, and Enrico Pyre, made estimates for what Pixie will do in the angular power spectrum. And they extended that to beyond lambda CDM, concerning things like neutrino masses and FNL. And so, yeah, you can measure the power spectrum in Pixie out to about L of 200. At low L, you get dominated by cosmic variance. At higher L, you do a little better.
I guess my point is you don't just get two numbers, you also get something about when the heating is happening. It's basically, so why is the total thermal energy, right? I guess it's just the total thermal energy sometimes, right?
Especially at low L, you're basically measuring the total thermal energy. There's no spatial information, especially at L of 200, unless it's a cluster like right in front of you.
No, but isn't there a spatial information? Because
not at L of 200, unless it's coma or other things like that.
So the thing is, if you have a structure at redshift 1 or a structure at redshift 0.1, they would appear on different scales because, just general structure in the universe appear on 100 megaparsec scale. So it would look smaller at redshift 1. So what would the L of 200?
It's something really, really large. So that's why I'm saying you just.
It's not one object. It's just general structure, like the peak of the power spectrum, right? So the thing is, a large scale.
It's still just Poisson contribution. So you can basically just to get that amplitude, you say, you don't worry about clustering. You say, well, we know
clustering. You just have one
of yeah, it's all Poisson. There is some clustering at the low L's, but that is, and that's where interesting effects, like say from FNL, start popping up. But that they're still small. I think they become dominant below L of 10. And there, you're swamped by cosmic variance. It's all in Hill Empire, so hopefully I've done that paper justice. But
I see. Okay, cool. Other questions for me? John?
I hope I'm not pushing things too long. The cosmology we do is based on an FIW background. Everything you told me. So when we do relativistic connections, we suspect that there's a failure.
Oh, sorry. These are relativistic corrections to the Y decrement. So what that means is you assume a non-thermal distribution of electrons. That's what I mean by That's what I mean by relativistic corrections. So the main Y spectral function assumes that you have a Maxwellian, perfectly thermal Maxwellian, and what you then want to do is add in what you think that non-thermal tail is going to be once you get to higher temperatures, say above KeVs in your clusters, and so that will cause a different scattering or slightly different spectral distortion, and so that's sort of so this is showing you sort of it's hard to see. This is the, you know, you can see how small the correction is. Non-relativistics in light blue, relativistics in blue. Yeah, it's tiny, but because, you know, we're going to detect this Y distortion at over 250 sigma if everything's correct. I mean, I think that's a fairly safe prediction, and 50 sigma if detection of the relativistic Y. And I say that's fairly safe because the main source of error here is actually cosmic variance, not the, if we went just with the Pixie specs for their instrumental noise, it's like a 2,000 sigma detection or something like that.
Okay, so we're having a lunch picnic right now down in the bistro, and we'll be having a good dinner also, same place at 6, so you're all welcome to join us. And
it'll be earlier, I'm catching a taxi at 5:30.
You are? Yeah. I have no idea, okay. So I guess I think I'm going to be too early for dinner because I don't think business starts.
Speak your lunch.
So everybody comes to lunch and let's double down on lunch. And Nick is going to be here at another 5:30, so try to find him before he leaves. Thanks.